Many of you will have heard of Maximilian of Mexico, the Emperor, but I fear because he represents an exhibition piece in the cabinet of mad monarchist curiosities. My impulse is to act against this fetishization or faux nostalgia for regimes that call themselves monarchies, and here to assess the imperial Mexican House of Cards objectively. I've been at pains to demonstrate continuity between the temperaments of the later Habsburgs, hence why it is a series and not simply an arrangement of separate biographies. I've contrasted the dogged dynasticism of the Emperor Francis, the first Emperor of Austria, with his creative yet politically inept brother Johann, the regent of revolutionary Germany, the absolutist and the artist. Such a dynamic was replicated in the generation of the Emperor Franz Joseph, with his brother Maximilian. While I began my talk on Franz Josef as the neo-absolutist, the visionary, refashioning the empire out of anarchy and chaos, in Maximilian of Mexico, this theme was taken to a farcical extreme. Each brother would suffer the consequences of their failure to bend political reality to their whims, both in the year 1867. For Franz Josef, failure represented a coronation in Budapest. For Maximilian, failure was represented by execution by firing squad. This is a segment taken from Martin Rady's The Habsburgs. As a boy, Franz Josef had delighted in his toy castle with its miniature soldiers and cannons, and he remained all his life passionate about the army, his soldiers' uniforms and parades. His younger brothers received an almost identical education and training, but each turned out differently. And this was very much the case with the children of Leopold II. Karl Ludwig was a zealous Catholic of no special talents. He was later known as the Exhibition Archduke, since his only task that he could perform competently was to represent the ruler at public events. He's also known for his vicarious contribution to the Austrian Empire, in the sense that he was the father of the heir to the throne, Franz Ferdinand, who was assassinated in Sarajevo in 1914, precipitating the July crisis, and he was the grandfather of the last emperor of Austria-Hungary, Emperor Karl. Ludwig Victor, Luzi-Wuzi, was mostly distinguished by his overt homosexuality and cross-dressing. He favoured silk frocks and was even eventually declared insane. There is one anecdote where Franz Josef actually banished his young brother from staying in Vienna and joked that Ludwig should be given a ballerina as an adjutant to keep him out of trouble. Nevertheless, as this pertains to Maximilian of Mexico, this episode, Max had even attempted to convince Ludwig to marry Princess Isabella of Brazil, the daughter of Pedro II, in the hope that the Habsburgs would eventually rule in Mexico and in Brazil, two Latin American empires, but of course, given the description of him that I've just given, that of course was doomed to failure. Very much a sense you can say that it echoes Maximilian's own fall. In contrast to his three siblings, Maximilian, although his official name was Ferdinand Maximilian, was the oldest of Franz Josef's three younger brothers. He was outgoing, charismatic, adventurous, and relatively balanced. The Archduchess Sophie, their mother, contrasted her two eldest sons when they were just 10 and 8, respectively. I must say that of all my boys, Franz Josef is the best behaved, but Maxi wins everyone's heart. Maxi has the richest spirit. Franz Josef remained jealous of Maximilian even after he became Emperor of Austria in 1848. Aware that he owed his position to a coup that had forced his uncle from office, Franz Josef feared that he might in turn be overthrown and replaced by his brother, This was part of the reason why the grandfather, Emperor Francis, was so determined to enshrine primogeniture at any costs. This idea of the more talented Habsburg brothers turning on each other. Although no liberal, Maximilian opposed the harsh regime imposed by his father, and his criticisms were gleefully reported to Franz Josef by the emperor's advisers. Again, of all the comments that Martin Brady makes, although no liberal is perhaps the most controversial of all, given the fact that when you read autobiographies or statements or even just contemporary accounts or recounting the reign of Maximilian, one of the words that routinely crops up is liberal, liberal. And in terms of understanding how he could not be a liberal, one could take it literally in the sense that because he was wedded to the idea of the empire, of the monarchist, and the vision of a monarchist ruling over Mexico, that one cannot necessarily be liberal in terms of perhaps having a moderating influence in terms of what the implications of that term really mean. But you can take liberal to be a political label, as was arising out of the Peninsular War in Spain in 1812, where the actual etymology comes from, hence my pronunciation. But you could also refer to liberal as a temperament, and in that sense, Maximilian was incontrovertibly a liberal. He was also a liberal in the sense that he saw himself very much as a secular reforming monarch. Indeed, perhaps a better word than liberal, because liberal has so many connotations, so many presentist associations, especially with the political situation in America, that I'm loath to use the word liberal under any context and during any context. But in this case, there is one characteristic that one can ascribe to Maximilian. It is clemency, Maximilian the Clement, to the extent that he would pardon his political enemies, including one Benito Juarez, the president of Mexico, and his clemency was such that in part it was responsible for his damnation. That is something you can take away from his character in terms of reclassifying liberalism here as clemency and trying to dispute what it means to be liberal by temperament and what it means to be liberal by politics. Accordingly, Franz Josef kept Maximilian away from Vienna and out of the political limelight, because very much in the mind of Franz Josef, his brother was a liberal. Whereas his two younger brothers received governorships and infantry regiments, Maximilian was appointed in 1850 to the command of a sailing sloop, Minerva, based in Trieste, what would later become the most important port city for the Habsburgs. As he wrote generously to his mother, "I am just a corvette captain, the last in rank of all the archdukes, but I stand on my own two feet and really hope to serve my revered emperor." Like the empress, Maximilian was thrilled by the lyrical verse of Heinrich Heine, whereas Sisi, the Empress Elizabeth, the wife of Franz Josef, was moved by Heine's melancholic songs of lost love and worldly disillusionment. Maximilian read them for their vivid tales of travel. Both adopted Heine's style in their writing. But Maximilian's descriptions were unfailingly wooden. For him, meadows were always emerald green, cliffs were always mighty, and the sea was always deep blue. Maximilian travelled extensively, mostly around the Mediterranean, but also down to the Atlantic and across the sea to Brazil, where he recorded his experiences in his travel sketches, which were themselves modelled on Heine's own travel pictures. It was in Spain that the mission and travel fused. There, Maximilian encountered, as he explained at the time, memories of the time when Spain was under the wings of the double-headed eagle, eternally embroidered by the sun at the highest summit of its power and the greatest empire in the world, regaling the fact that, of course, the Habsburgs had ruled in Spain up until 1701. Attending a bullfight in 1851, he imagined the onlookers paying him homage, and he dreamt back to the fine times when the Habsburgs were the rulers of this noble people. In Granada, he knelt before the tomb of Ferdinand of Aragon, grandfather of Emperor Charles V, as a traveller in a foreign land, but as the closest legal descendant of the dead man. He mused that the golden sceptre of the Habsburgs had been broken in Spain, but addressing himself, that it shines plus ultra to you, further and beyond. Again, the spirit of the mission and travel of the Spanish Empire. Despite his appeal to the plus ultra of Charles V, the destiny that Maximilian sought was not founded in ideas of world empire and of service to the faith. It rested instead on a wistful reading of the past, learned from Washington Irving's romantic histories of Spain and on frustration at his own situation. After the birth of a son, Rudolf, to Franz Josef and Sisi in 1858, The chance of Maximilian succeeding his brother became virtually nil. Instead, he had to make do with naval duties. Appointed rear admiral and overall commander of the fledgling Habsburg fleet in 1854, he pushed for naval expansion and was responsible for the introduction of screw-driven ironclads. He sponsored the circumnavigation of the globe by the Navarra in 1857 to 1859. Maximilian was sufficiently reconciled to a career in the margins to begin the construction in 1856 of his own fairy tale building just outside Trieste. It was the battlements and lavish rooms of Bellamara, with its park laid out to receive exotic ginkgos and giant sequoias, that Maximilian brought his new wife, Princess Charlotte, Carlotta of Belgium, in 1857, very much in the vogue of, say, the Hohenzollern Castle of King Frederick Wilhelm IV of Prussia, or the new Hohenschwangau of his namesake Maximilian in Bavaria. There's also another note here in terms of continuity between the Habsburgs, the obsession with travel, expansion, the melancholy associated with the lost Habsburg evil in Habsburg eagle in Spain. I recall this notion of the tragedy, the trauma of the Emperor Charles the Sixth, the Holy Roman Emperor, not Charles V, the Emperor who Maximilian would like to adulate in some way, or at least give some sort of ode or sort of memorial to, in the form of Charles VI. He lost the throne in Spain. He was chased out of Aragon in his own capital of Barcelona, and the Habsburgs lost Spain forever. And thereafter, he would enmesh Vienna, Austria, in a rigid and melancholy Spanish court culture. He would also, however, be a naval pioneer in the case of the Ostend Company. So very much lingering elements, not just of Charles V, but of Charles VI in terms of the legacy of Maximilian. Indeed, if I'm going back to this idea of Maximilian as Maximilian the Liberal, or rather more specifically, Maximilian the Clement, I can ascribe the pardoning of Benito Juarez very much to one of Charles V's greatest mistakes, which was to release the captive King Francis after the Battle of Pavia. Maximilian and Charlotte's marriage was one of love. It came, however, at a high price to Charlotte's father, King Leopold I of Belgium, who had to make over a sizable dowry, which went immediately into the depleted Austrian treasury. In return, Leopold asked Franz Josef to find his new son-in-law a more suitable vocation, on which account Franz Josef appointed Maximilian governor of the province of Lombardy-Venetia. This was a poison chalice laced with gunpowder. Habsburg rule was deeply resented in the province, yet the terms of Maximilian's appointment forbade him from engaging in any course of action that might have made his government acceptable to most Italians. Even so, he ignored Franz Josef's instruction that he should use severity in the event even of the most small revolt. On the 19th of April 1859, Franz Josef dismissed Maximilian. Within 2 months, Austrian rule had collapsed in Lombardy. Now that's a rather a disingenuous association in terms of Martin Brady implying that that was the direct result of the Habsburg rule collapsing because of Maximilian's deposition. Rather, it was lost as a result of war, as a result of Franz Josef's defeat at the Battle of Solferino, and the French intervention to help the Kingdom of Piedmont-Sardinia defeat the Austrians. The Austrians, by the way, were the dominant power in northern Italy. They ruled over the core of the northeast, which was Lombardy, Milan, Venetia, Venice, and also holding in tandem the duchies of Lucca, of Modena, of Tuscany, and of course an alliance with the Papal States. The great anomaly in all of this, of course, was Piedmont, which only 10 years before had declared war on Austria with the attempt of wresting all these provinces away from Austria and creating a revolutionary kingdom of Italy under Piedmont, something that would be achieved as a result of the war in 1859 with France. But it's interesting again to consider more objectively what the implications were of Maximilian's viceroyal position in northern Italy. He was viceroy under the 90-year-old Radetzky of the Radetzky March, who had quashed the rebellion at the age of 80 in 1848 against the forces of King Albert of Piedmont. In the capacity of viceroy, Maximilian dedicated himself to building projects, swamp drainage, irrigation, canals, etc. He was also very much invested in public demonstrations of the dynasty to the people, such as Carlotta and himself riding gondola rides throughout Venice, etc. Indeed, you have to understand that in terms of his position in Italy, it was a purview which was severely restricted by the machinations of his brother Franz Josef. Indeed, it seems rather novel that of all the vocations that Franz Josef could have given his brother, who he accused essentially of conspiring to take over the throne, with really no evidence at all apart from his own sort of personal jealousy, that he instead chose to give his brother one of the most tumultuous of all the provinces of the empire in 1857 to 1859. Indeed, in 1859, he was effectively subordinated to the whims of one General Frank Giuliani. Effectively, it had all the characteristics of a military occupation following a series of unrests in 1859. Indeed, if you're going to remark on the legacy of Maximilian in Italy, there's a rather sarcastic attribution given by Cavour. Cavour, who was the prime minister of the Kingdom of Piedmont, Cavour, who'll be instrumental in defeating the Austrians and wooing Napoleon III over to the side of the Kingdom of Piedmont and over Italian unification, and thus was the great mastermind, or you can almost say the Bismarck of Italy. And he said this of Maximilian. In Lombardy, our worst enemy was the Archduke Maximilian, young, active, enterprising, who dedicated himself completely to the difficult task of winning over the Milanese, and he was about to triumph in it. The Lombardian provinces had never been so prosperous or so well administered. Thank God for the good government of Vienna to intervene and, as usual, took advantage of the opportunity to commit a blunder, an impudent one, an impudent act, one most fatal to Austria, but most advantageous to Piedmont. Lombardy shall now fall into our grasp. And indeed it did. But this, of course, is rather indicative of something that'll characterize his regime in Mexico, that Maximilian is ultimately well-intentioned, he is intelligent, and yet he is also naive. He is out of his depth, and to some extent his regime is reliant on the forces of military powers outside of his control, in the case of Franz Josef, or later in the case of Napoleon III of France and Mexico. But in a sense, these are also resented as the forces of foreign occupation in both instances. So you would have thought that this would be a apprenticeship, a training ground for what would later happen in Mexico, which was far more fraught in terms of his own position and fear for his own life. But he doesn't seem to have learned anything from his experience in Italy. Maximilian was not the only prince who believed that he had a historic mission to play on the world stage. Napoleon III of France was equally convinced of the part to which he, as the nephew and namesake of the first Napoleon, was predestined. In Europe, he championed Italian independence and support for Turkey against Russia. North Africa, the African coast, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia were in turn the other targets of Napoleon III's ambitions. The Americas offered him, however, an opportunity which might be justified as much by strategy as by vanity. French policy had long been opposed to the expansion of the United States as endangering the balance of power in the New World. On this account, France had, in the 1840s, backed an independent Texas. And in the next decade, until naval demonstrations in support of Mexico in its war against the United States. The outbreak of the American Civil War in 1861 temporarily removed the geopolitical threat posed by the United States, but Napoleon was determined to put an end to further expansion from the north. Just as Britain and France's earlier intervention in Crimea in support of the Ottoman Turks had stopped Russian movement along the Black Sea coast, so France would now make Mexico the stumbling block. Napoleon considered French intervention there not to be enough. To defend itself in the long term, Mexico needed stable rule. In the 40 years since independence, Mexico had no less than 50 different governments, most of them military regimes. In Napoleon's view, only a monarchy could rebuild the Mexican nation and forge the unity needed to prevent further losses of its territory to the United States. Maximilian was an obvious choice for ruler. He wasn't, by the way, the first choice. The first appeal by the Mexican emigres instead went to France, wanting to appeal to one of the sons of Louis-Philippe, the recently deposed King of the French. After Maximilian's dismissal as governor of Lombardy-Venetia, Maximilian had languished in frustration, spending most of his time either travelling or developing the Miramare estate. Both he and Carlotta were convinced that they had by birth and aptitude a right to more. Already on visit to Brazil in 1860, Maximilian had felt a surge of emotion when standing as the first Habsburg prince on the shores of the New World, and he had once pontificated on the scheme of government most suited to Latin America. a wise tyrant, you could even say in the mold of Joseph II, an enlightened despot, who melded iron discipline with justice. He was ready for the part allotted by fate. For Napoleon, the Habsburg was an ideal candidate. Franz Josef's cooperation was furthermore guaranteed, for the scheme of making Maximilian ruler of Mexico would both enhance the prestige of the House of Habsburg and yet rid Franz Josef of his brother's shadow. The problem was that Mexico already had a government under the presidency of the Republican politician Benito Juarez. Mexican historians had conventionally seen this attempt to establish a monarchy in Mexico as a vain attempt to halt the country's progress towards a modern republic. In fact, as one of Mexico's greatest scholars, Edmundo O'Gorman, long argued, there is also in Mexican politics a conservative tradition upon which a monarchical movement could build. Mexican conservatism was strongly Catholic and opposed the Republican program of closing monasteries, seizing land, and harrying priests. Yet it was ready to embrace moderate reforms in the interests of sound administration. It certainly had a following that was larger than a handful of military men, clerics, and landowners described in the accounts of most Mexican historians. As O'Gorman argued, there was thus nothing quaint about installing a Habsburg as Mexico's ruler, but this was an authentic possibility for the national being. The book that Rady is referring to is Edmundo O'Gorman's revisionist history, The Political Survival of New Spain, 1969, which is in Spanish for people who can't read Spanish. Nevertheless, there is an article which is based upon this book by Erica Pani, Dreaming of a Mexican Empire, The Political Projects of the Imperialistas. Indeed, if you're looking at a tangent of Mexican historiography, throughout the fall of the military regime that fell in 1911 and the subsequent Mexican Revolution, the anti-clerical revolution that followed, and finally the stabilization of the Cárdenas regime in the 1930s, it really does seem that Mexican history is a long civil war in some respects, punctuated by moments of temporary stability. And in this sense, beyond the whole dichotomy of this conservative continuation, Maximilian actually fits rather nicely into this whole scheme. But I'm reading here from an article by Nancy Barker, Monarchy in Mexico, Harebrained Scheme or A Well-Considered Prospect. Ever since the egregious and tragic failure of Napoleon III's attempt to place the Archduke Ferdinand Maximilian on a throne in Mexico, virtually all but the participants have tended to view his enterprise as a species of folly. Whether they believe his motives to have been quixotic or meanly avaricious, historians generally agree in blaming ignorance as the basic cause of the fiasco. Avaricious in the sense that this was nothing more than a cynical attempt to take back Francis's debts from their investment in Mexico, of which was a recurring theme in the 19th century gunboat diplomacy. But of course, quixotic in the sense that one could refer to Maximilian's own fascination with travel and his lionization for the legacy of Charles V and plus ultra, very much defining that legacy. Instead of informing himself accurately on the true conditions in Mexico, the argument runs that Napoleon allowed himself to be hoodwinked by a handful of self-serving émigrés and deluded by the clerical enthusiasms of the Empress Eugenie. Empress Eugenie is actually worth having her own sort of a dedicated episode on, in terms of all the quote-unquote petticoat diplomacies that she's going to be involved on. One aspect of this, of course, is her strong defence of Catholicism, ultramontanism, and indeed you can say the friendly overtures that she made to Austria, which in my view would have better served France rather than allying with the Piedmontese in 1859. But regardless, without a shred of evidence, wrote a prominent British historian of the Second Empire, Napoleon persuaded himself of the existence of a strong monarchist movement that would welcome a prince as a liberator. He was badly informed because he did nothing to inform himself. Well, concludes the foremost French authority on the Mexican expedition. Hence, he failed to recognize what now seems self-evident, that a foreign monarchy could not have taken root on the American continent, and that the experiment must inevitably have led to disaster. Again, a teleological, secularist version of history, which runs against this whole notion of history as a series of arguments running in tandem. One has to consider not just what happened, but what could have happened. And in a sense, this disbarring of counterfactuals makes all history seem predetermined, and that is very much an impulse that historians should be aware of and attempt to circumvent. Unfortunately for Napoleon, these clear-sighted critics were not available for his consultation when he was formulating his grande pensée, i.e., grand vision of the French Empire. As a 19th-century statesman, he cannot be expected to have seen anything inherently unworkable in the imposition of a prince of one nationality on another. Who better than his Habsburg protégé could have been expected to face such a contingency with equanimity? Transfers of princes from throne to throne and country to country were commonplace in Europe in the first half of the 19th century. The Congress of Vienna, as the textbooks affirm, had moved kings about the map of Europe like pieces on a chessboard, and judged by the record of other great men, a great peace settlements with no small degree of success. The following decades saw numerous interventions by the powers, either in defense of beleaguered monarchs or in the expeditions to implant a ruler of their choice in the troubled area. The examples of Greece in the 1820s and Belgium in 1830 come immediately to mind. In the case of Greece, it was the King Otto of Wittelsbach. In the case of 1830, it is Maximilian's own father-in-law, Leopold I of Belgium. In Brazil, when Napoleon III began his reign, a Bragança seemed securely seated on the throne, Bragança being the imperial and royal house of Portugal. The Brazilian Revolution had come in the 1820s. The House of Bragança split, one ruling over Portugal, another ruling over Brazil. And during the reign of Pedro II, it seemed very much that Napoleon was right to look on the Brazilian example as an imperial success story. Indeed, this is very much the example that you can say informed most of Maximilian's political thinking, and indeed formed such a large sort of sector of his intrigues, especially when it pertains to his desire to see his younger brother married off and become emperor of Brazil in his own right. Not surprisingly, representatives from Spain regarded the separation of Mexico from the mother country as an aberration of temporary nature. The first among these, one Angel Calderón de la Barca, found republicanism in Mexico a farce, as if it were completely foreign to the ancient and present habits of customs of Mexico. What they mean by this again is referring back to Edmondo O'Gorman's idea of the continuation of the settlement of New Spain, i.e., there is a king, there is a viceroy representing the king, and there is the Empire of the Indies holding this delicate patchwork of the Mexican Empire together. In the sense, you can say that empire is the ancient mold going all the way back to Montezuma and the Aztecs before, rather than looking at this American importation of Republican norms. They are very much considered to be the aberration here. Calderon's successors echoed his views and at time worked actively with Mexican monarchists on behalf of a European prince. In 1843, the Spanish minister Pedro Pascal Oliva advised Madrid, constitutional monarchy with a European prince would certainly be the form of government that could raise the country from its present degradation and prostration and restrain its pride and hatred of foreigners. Effectively, what this actually refers to is back in the 1820s, during the height of the Mexican Revolution, one of the generals, Augustin, declared himself Emperor of Mexico, on the Napoleonic model. It didn't last, and he was eventually deposed and replaced by the cliques of Santa Anna, etc. But nevertheless, the Spanish, of course, were offered the title of Emperor of Mexico during the height of the Revolution. King Ferdinand of Spain did not accept the title of Emperor of Mexico, but it's clear to see that whether they be Carlists or whether they be Spanish princes or even Spanish generals in the form of Marshal Prim, the Spanish never gave up on this idea of restoring some form of monarchical settlement in Mexico, which had been the Viceroyalty of New Spain. In dealing with the expansionist pressure of Russia against the Ottoman Empire, diplomats made a pastime of revising the map of Eastern Europe with boundaries and princes to serve their interests. In the case of Turkey, it had become peculiarly analogous to that of Mexico in the 1850s when England and France went to her defence in the Crimean War, again referring back to Napoleon III's foreign policy. Mexico was frequently seen as a sort of Turkey of the New World. The Mexican head of state Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna, pleading for the aid of France and England, spoke most bitterly of the betrayal of those powers who would support the Turks against the Russians, believed the Mexicans to be destroyed by the North Americans. Consequently, in January of 1854, when Santa Anna instructed the monarchist emigre, Don José María Gutiérrez Estrada, to carry his proposal of intervention to the French and British courts, d'Estrada, by the way, is the man who would formally invite Maximilian himself to become Emperor of Mexico, the possibility of success was real. Many of the elements that prompted the later expedition by the French of 1861 were already present: an acute fear of aggression by the United States, virtual bankruptcy of the Mexican treasury, with intermittent suspension of payments for foreign debt, which, in the case of England, was sizable. An adventurer on the throne of France, Napoleon III, was already formulating a grand design to oblige Austria to cede Lombardy, Venetia to a revolutionary kingdom of Italy, and to find compensation for the House of Habsburg elsewhere. And again, it should be ironic in terms of looking at this idea of compensation for the House of Habsburg, that it would be the very viceroy who had recently ruled over Lombardy, Venetia, who would be directly compensated in the mind of Napoleon with the Empire of Mexico. An additional factor favourable to this intervention in 1854 was the extension of the invitation to the emperor by the head of the Mexican state himself, rather than those displaced from power, as was the case in 1861. Nonetheless, two other circumstances ruled out intervention in 1854. The United States, although internally divided, was not yet in the midst of civil war and might be expected to offer resistance, as per the Monroe Doctrine. Second, the outbreak of the Crimean War in March of 1854 absorbed the energies of England and France for two more years. The Mexican sick man had yet to yield precedence to the Turkish sick man. However, by the time of 1861, France was now determined to restore its relations with Austria following the Franco-Austrian War that had cost Maximilian's former viceroyalty in Lombardy. Mexico was marred by the Reform War, waged by Benito Juarez, that drove many conservatives further into the camps of the monarchist. And America was now in a state of civil war. Napoleon III was informed by his advisor, Dubois de Saligny, that the liberal republican government of Benito Juarez was completely without support, and that a mere French expedition of 5,000 men would be sufficient to collapse the regime. Small wonder that the emperor did not doubt the feasibility of this grand design. In sponsoring a European prince in 1861, he was taking an action that had long been urgently recommended by intelligent, highly placed, and experienced men on both sides of the Atlantic. Edouard Thevenel, the emperor's foreign minister in 1861, although European-oriented and of pragmatic disposition, was completely indoctrinated into this line of thinking. This government for the Latin races, is it possible except under a monarchy? He questioned rhetorically in a private letter to the French ambassador in London, one Count Flahault, in 1861. "I think not," he answered, his own question, "and everyone assures me that all honest and sensible people in Mexico think the same." The general acceptance of the monarchist thesis should occasion no astonishment. The continuous political turbulence in Latin American republics appeared as prima facie evidence of this truth. In any case, it might be argued that monarchy never had a real test in Mexico. Maximilian proved, however, to be a severe disappointment to the supporters of monarchy, both French and Mexican, who were usually conservative in their views. As emperor, he surrounded himself with liberals and very soon alienated the church on which the conservatives relied for support. His policies were completely at variance with the principles formerly enunciated in monarchist newspapers, such as El Tiempo, and by earlier prominent conservatives such as Lucas Alamán. Those who had worked for his reign felt a bitter sense of betrayal at this liberal course, again going back to Martin Radi's interesting use of rejecting that terminology. In his Council of State in 1864, one of its only members, Teodoro Solares, was of the conservative monarchist party. He would have nothing to do with the ultra-conservative Gutiérrez de Estrada, and, after tolerating José Manuel Hidalgo as his minister of Paris for a time, owing to his popularity with the imperial couple, Napoleon and Eugenie, he dismissed him from his post when he realized how badly his ideas were being represented at the French court. At the onset of intervention, during its early stages, rare were the voices raised in protest. Although the British government was unwilling to involve itself in an invasion of Mexico, both Palmerston and Sir Charles Wyke, British minister in Mexico, believed that monarchy was a correct solution for the country. Leopold, that Coburg king of the Belgians, although cautious as usual, did not discourage his son-in-law Maximilian from considering the Mexican throne when his advice was asked. Mexico was best suited for monarchy, he wrote, and that the elements of political unity exist. In the Austrian government, Count Johann Bernhard Rechberg, foreign minister, was immediately concerned lest acceptance of a crown by the Archduke led later to a demand for a sacrifice by Austria as a quid pro quo, but he could not deny that elevation of Maximilian to the throne of Mexico would lend to a new distinction to the House of Habsburg, a quid pro quo in the possibility of a French alliance with Austria that never materialized. Prince Richard von Metternich, Austrian ambassador in Paris, was sceptical from the first. However, exposed daily to the Empress's naive plans for disposing of excess royalty in the New World, especially Carlos, he tended to regard this undertaking as a foolish example of petticoat diplomacy, in the case of the Empress Eugenie, not the Empress Carlotta. This view has persisted. The Empress's strong advocacy for the venture, her total ignorance of Latin America, whose people, she thought, were the same as the Spanish race, committed to accentuate the latter belief that monarchy had been romantic from the outset. Maximilian was formally offered the throne of Mexico in 1863, going back to Martin Brady, by a delegation of conservative leaders who addressed him in the Miramar Palace as a worthy descendant of the Emperor Charles V. His monarchy was also to be an empire, and thus to be an emperor, because this was thought to be the developing style in the New World, a la going back to Brazil. Having accepted the title, Maximilian busied himself with diplomatic and practical preparations. He was under no illusion about the scale of the task before him, having received from the Austrian ambassador in Washington ominous warnings about the difficulties he would face. Accordingly, he sought military guarantees of support from Napoleon, which the French ruler readily gave. Franz Josef was less accommodating. While he promised some limited financial support and allowed Maximilian to enlist a volunteer force from the Habsburg lands, he unnecessarily demanded that his brother repudiate his rights and titles as a Habsburg. Should the venture fail, Maximilian would thus return to Europe as less than an archduke, and any children he and Charlotte might have would also be deprived of rank. The stakes were high, and Maximilian almost threw in his hand. As he remarked in April of 1864, only a few days before he was due to embark, "For my part, if someone were to tell me that everything was off, I would shut myself up in my room and jump for joy." In the intervening time, French troops had invaded Mexico on the pretext of recovering loans owed to the French government and banks. Landing in Veracruz in December of 1861, a 6,000-strong force made its way inland. The French commanders were convinced, again by the advice given by Napoleon III, that they would face nothing but a rabble, but the forces mustered by the Republicans were disciplined. When outnumbered, they took to guerrilla tactics. Napoleon's response to the slowness of the French advance was to throw increasing numbers of troops into the fray. By the middle of 1863, he had committed almost 40,000 men. In June of that year, Mexico City finally fell, again bear in mind 18 months after the original invasion, and a new regency government took over on Maximilian's behalf. Still in Miramar, Maximilian expressed concern that the Republicans had been ousted by force, and he questioned whether there was genuine support for monarchy. Accordingly, in every territory that the French forces overran, they held plebiscites, which were neither free nor fair, and again, this is simply standard fare for any Bonapartist government, which is there by right of plebiscite. As one of the Mexican politicians stated in a letter to Maximilian, these confirmed that three-quarters of the total territory of Mexico and four-fifths of her whole population were declared for the monarchy. But again, to say that the Republican regime under Benito Juarez, the military cliques of Santa Anna, were in any way democratic by comparison is also complete and utter nonsense. On the 28th of May 1864, Maximilian and Charlotte disembarked at Veracruz with more than 500 pieces of luggage, including carriages, crates of bone china bearing the Mexican imperial arms that Maximilian had designed himself, crystal goblets, furnishing, and fine wines. It should be interesting that if you look at the coat of arms designed by Maximilian, it very much is in the style indicative of the Napoleonic Empire. Indeed, there are many comparisons that one can draw to Napoleon III in the case of both brothers, Franz Josef and Maximilian. Franz Josef, in the sense that he very much took Napoleon III of his model in terms of reconquering the population, and being able to reorder the empire as a new centralist construct. And the case of Maximilian, of course, in terms of being that great adventurer overseas, expanding the monarchist principle in terms of the empire as not only a viable form of government, but the best form of government, one that should be exported all across the world. The progress to Mexico City took a fortnight on a narrow gauge railway and along rusted tracks. During the 6 week voyage from Trieste, Maximilian had composed a monumental guide to court etiquette, the Reglamento para el Servicio Ceremonial de la Corte, consisting of seating plans for dinners and other ceremonies, and orders of precedence, including 100 separate ranks, with minute attention to detail. The Reglamento amounted to almost 600 pages. The delicacies will be laid out in the dining room. As soon as the imperial couple approach the table, the secretaries of ceremonies will enter the dining room, followed close behind by the men of the palace guard. The first secretary of the ceremonies will attend the table of the gentlemen, and the second secretary the table of the ladies. At this point, the emperor will hand his sombrero to the attending field adjutant, and the empress her handkerchief and a fan to attending the maid of honor. Maximilian also prescribed a minimum height for the troops of the palace guard. They were to be no less than 6 feet, 6 inches tall, 12-inch high silver helmets, each crowned with an imperial eagle, topped them off. It is easy to be scornful on Maximilian's endeavours, but the Reglamento had a greater purpose than just etiquette. Maximilian intended to make his court the centre of all political life in Mexico, which united all parties and opinions in common performance of rituals and obeisance. Where their content affected the indigenous population, Maximilian published his decrees in the Nahuatl language, which is the only occasion in Mexico's history when the government did so. For those not invited to Maximilian's new palace outside Mexico City, he gave a redesigned capital with parks, fountains, gas lighting, and a broad boulevard modelled on the Paris Champs-Élysées. Yet Maximilian's endeavours to reconcile the factions and broaden his support went beyond ceremony and symbolism. And again, we can very much see this in the own example he had led in Milan. On the first entering of the National Palace, which housed the new ministries, he found complete disarray. No filing systems, correspondence unregistered, documents heaped on the floor, and no set hours for work. Appointing and promoting on the basis of merit, without regard for party affiliation, he put together an administration that embarked on a programme of radical reform. Universal elementary education was mandated, debt servitude and child labour abolished, hours of work and lunch breaks were regulated, and the communal property and water rights of the indigenous people were protected. No less significant were Maximilian's reforms of government and law. In order to break the power of regional bosses or cordillos, he divided the country into 50 provinces, each headed by a prefect appointed by him. And this is again very much off the model of the département system with the intendants that we see in Imperial France. Administrative courts took over from the slow-moving judiciary, the resolution of disputes between individuals and agencies of government. At the end of 1865, the fruits of a committee drawn up of lawyers across the political spectrum were published in the form of a civil code, very much like the Napoleonic Code, that regulated family law, inheritance, property, and contracts. Declared abolished by the Republican government in 1867, three quarters of this code were nonetheless included in the new Republican Civil Code of 1870. The Civil Code illustrates the difficulty that Maximilian faced in order to make his regime acceptable to most Mexicans. He embraced an essentially Republican program of modernization. In so doing, he jettisoned the conservatives, not restoring the oppressive rights of landowners, again, oppressive very much in terms of the view of Ready, of the Catholic clergy, all their property. Indeed, Maximilian went further, entrenching civil marriage and full religious toleration in his civil code. And yet, Maximilian was not acceptable to the Republican camp on account of his imperial title and the symbols of royalty that he so assiduously burnished. The consequence was that instead of creating unity beneath the crown, he manufactured a void. That in the fact that he had also deposed Benito Juarez and all of his ministers who had a vested interest in retaining their position, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that he would have wanted to receive full international recognition for the empire, i.e. American recognition for the empire, but he offered clemency to Benito Juarez while the Americans still did not recognize his government. You can say that from a political point of view, it was stupid and ultimately futile. But nevertheless, again, going back to the legacy of someone like his predecessor, Johann, the regent of revolutionary Germany, combined with this sort of pragmatic politics that you see with Francis, we see with Franz Josef, in the form of Maximilian, we have the idealist, the artist par excellence. In terms of how far he's willing to go to enact this quote-unquote republican, or one can say more accurately, sort of Napoleonic republican form of government. Indeed, if you look at the Empress Eugenie, you can say that the French were more committed to Catholicism in Mexico than Maximilian was. Indeed, Maximilian was directly rebuffed by the papal nuncio sent over in 1864, one Pier Francesco Melida, who warned that the Pope's support of the regime would be rescinded should it be perceived to have become ungodly, which is very much a concern of the Mexican Catholics and indeed of the Church, who believe Maximilian would come and restore their rights following the Reform War. Maximilian had essentially hacked at all the pillars of a regime, as a Maximilian would effectively come to be the equivalent of a Mexican Joseph II of Austria, who likewise was in a mad rush to legislate on every aspect of life in Mexico, as we have seen from the regulation of lunch breaks, the abolition of corvée labor, the introduction of indigenous rights, and of course, mandated public education. All of these things, again, going back to the legacy of his predecessor, Joseph II in Austria. And one perfect example to encapsulate all of that is in terms of this vast breadth of legal proceedings, they were compiled in 8 volumes of law during a 3-year reign. But to the horror of the monarchist camp, these laws were not repudiations of the settlements from the Republicans or the anti-clerical reform war, but rather you can say they were embellishments. It represented continuity. And as we see with the new Republican Civil Code of 1870, Maximilian was, in some senses, more of a continuation of the regimes that came before rather than aberration. Indeed, you can look at the tendencies of Mexican historiography to demonize Ferdinand. You can say it is actually coming from a prejudice directed against the idea of a self-designated monarchy, as opposed to the reforms that he actually intended to introduce, which were again seen as part of a consistent secularist, centralizing liberal core around the reglamento, the idea of this imperial court culture put at the top of a fundamentally republican mode of government. And of course, it is no wonder that everyone found this baffling. And in a sense, what could have been a continuation of New Spain, this idea of the alliance between the scepter and the altar, the Catholic Church, the conservative elements, the landowners, the hidalgos, the sort of minor landowning aristocracy. Instead, what was taken, essentially a position was afforded to him with a constituency that backed him. And what Maximilian did was attempt to fashion his own position out of nothing. Indeed, if you look at, say, for example, the comments of Francisco Anguaz, he referred to him essentially as a creative genius, a Caesarian, without any genuine supporters. Indeed, it seemed that his motivation was to present himself as the great civilizing hope of Mexico for the sake of international opinion and not really for the sake of actually ensuring that that would become the case in Mexico. Going back to Reidy, the end came swiftly. At its height, the French military contribution to Maximilian amounted to 45,000 French troops, plus the pay and equipping of 7,000 Mexican regulars and about 20,000 auxiliaries, including Austrian and Belgian volunteers, the supporters from his father-in-law and indeed from his brother, but again, emphasis on volunteers. Franz Josef was not prepared to prop up this failing, quote-unquote, Habsburg regime in Mexico. And again, compare this to the earlier assertion by Dessalines that only 4,000 troops would be needed to depose the regime, and thereafter you can essentially say that Maximilian's position would last. With the end of the American Civil War in 1867, the Republican forces were able to equip with surplus weaponry and take out international loans. At the same time, Napoleon III came under pressure at home to rein in French finances and to prepare an army for any expected conflict with Prussia. This during the 1866 war between Prussia and Austria. Republican tactics ominously changed from guerrilla tactics to broad offensives. The next year, the French withdrawal commenced. a desperate voyage by the Empress Carlotta to France, where she pleaded with Napoleon to delay the evacuation, proved hopeless. Distraught and convinced that Napoleon was trying to poison her, Carlotta took temporary refuge in the Vatican as an unwelcome guest of then Pope Pius IX. Her descent into madness had begun. The Spanish general Juan Prim had warned Napoleon III that a foreign monarch imposed on the Mexicans by force of French arms will have nothing to sustain him. On the day that his support is withdrawn, he will fall from the throne erected by your majesty. And so it came to pass. Left with only 20,000 volunteer troops after the French withdrawal, Maximilian was first pushed out of the countryside and then out of the towns. So why, if this advice was given to Napoleon back in 1862, was this advice ignored, and why did Napoleon believe that the monarchist cause in Mexico was irresistible and too tantalizing to ignore? Well, partly because many in Spain and France believed that Juan Prim didn't want Maximilian to become the emperor. He instead wanted to become the emperor of Mexico. And so his opinion, even though it proved to be correct, was discounted on those grounds. Early on in 1867, Maximilian abandoned Mexico City and made his headquarters at Querétaro, 200 kilometers northwest of the capital. 3 months later, that city fell and Maximilian was betrayed. After a brief trial, and notwithstanding the previous abolition of the death penalty in Mexico, he was condemned to the firing squad along with two of his generals. As he went to his execution on the 19th of June 1867, he remarked on the weather, "What a beautiful day. I have always wanted to die on a day like this." As he stood before the firing squad, Maximilian delivered a final oration, "Mexican, men of my class and origins are appointed by God to the happiness of people or their martyrs. Called by some of you, I came for the good of the country. I did not come for ambition. I hope that my blood will be the last to be spilled, and I pray that it regenerates this unhappy country. Viva Mexico! Viva la Independencia!" As previously agreed, two generals stood on either side of Maximilian to recall Christ's crucifixion. Indeed, it should also be noted that he's very much trying to mimic the guillotining of Louis the 16th of France during the French Revolution, with specific reference to, "I pray that the blood you are about to be spilled will not be revisited on France." This was a choreographed death, which played on the themes of mission and of Christ-like martyrdom and redemption, which again is ironic considering the fact that the church felt so utterly betrayed by the policies of Maximilian, i.e. secular and republican. Stories abounded to lend credence to the simulacrum, that the bullets tore into Maximilian had formed on his shirt the sign of the cross, that a crown of thorns had materialized over his portrait in Melamali, and so on. Images and sketches of the execution were reproduced across Europe and America, as well as one of the first faked photographs. Most famously, the death of Maximilian was the subject of four paintings and a lithograph by Edward Manet. In all but one of these, the troops performing the execution are dressed not as Mexicans, but as French soldiers, thus pointing to Napoleon III's responsibility for Maximilian's death. Responsibility in the sense that he was the main pioneer of the intervention, but of course, when French public opinion turned against him and he no longer sought to financially benefit from it, as the Americans were prepared to enforce the Monroe Doctrine, Napoleon III abandoned Mexico to focus instead on Prussia. Franz Josef was unmoved by his brother's death, commenting only that his skills as a huntsman will be missed at the next shoot. But even so, we may still look forward to good sport.